one should be skeptical. And you should not. Judaism is unique among all the religions. We're not taking that up now, but God does not expect a person. I was just discussing it today with my students. It's a very, very, what I'm going to say is very controversial. But all religions are rooted in the idea of faith. Faith. That is to say that they encourage you to go by your inner feelings. You have faith, you believe, and because you believe in something, and you should live. And that's a wonderful thing. If a person, for example, would sacrifice his life because of his faith, because he deep down really believes that this is true, that this is what whatever he's worshiping wants from him. So most people would say that's a wonderful thing. But I maintain that Judaism, not everybody, every rabbi will agree with me either on this, but I maintain that Judaism does not admire that at all. To the contrary, it could be something very, very foolish. Is there any, in most areas of life where you operate on that principle, where you go along with someone, take a look at the whole economy as falling apart, and in addition to this new crisis with this Madoff, is that the name of the person?
Madoff,
yeah. Madoff, it's unbelievable what's going on. We're living in unbelievable times. Aside from all, I'm very concerned about the anti-Semitic factor. I mean, this is essentially involving Jews and corruption and so forth. It gives people, it's not the fault of the Jewish people, obviously, but it certainly, gives people the opportunity to castigate the Jews. But look at the gullibility of people. It's just an amazing thing. There's nothing more amazing in all areas where gullibility in human relationships, marriages, divorce, and all of the people believe it has to be, because I feel a certain way about something, a person has a natural, I guess God designed us this way, with that if I feel it's meant to be, and because I feel so profoundly, that's a proof. The fact that I feel so strongly about something means it's got to be true. And people go ahead and they enter into all kinds of relationships, and whether it's marriage and whether it's business and trust. The amazing thing, you trust with millions of dollars without any objective evidence, simply because you're convinced it has to be that way. That's gullibility. So in these areas, if I told you that it's ridiculous that you should not invest your money on the basis of faith, but you should test it out, I think you'll pretty much agree with me. Unfortunately, when there's strong emotions and a person has that idea, he feels that he's going to get rich quick, he may not always be willing to do that. But at least you'll agree with me intellectually. And I think with regard to relationships, I think people are wise enough, given the tremendous breakdown of marriage, the divorce rate, I think people understand that that's not sufficient. It's important to feel a certain way, but the fact that you feel so strongly about the goodness of the person is absolutely no proof that he's really good. There's no connection between the two. It's a painful thing because these are very cherished emotions and everybody wants to believe in it. When it comes to religion, what's the difference? Just because you feel that way, does that mean that it's true? Because you're convinced that this person, you see these people on TV sometimes, they're very convincing people. All of these, most of them anyways, these great evangelical leaders, these unbelievable speakers, they're masters. And you could look at the audience, they're so rapt, they would follow them anywhere. Like that Johnstown is a perfect example of that. That's not the only case. All of his followers, they gave up their life to this person. They believed that he was a god, a prophet, whatever it was. To the extent that it overrode the ordinary instinct of self-preservation. When he told them that we have to drink the Kool-Aid, they all, pretty much all of them, maybe a couple of exceptions, there were a couple of, they just did a show on it recently. You know, I remember when it happened. It shows you the gullibility that people have, especially in the realm of religion. That's a very dangerous kind of thing. Very, very dangerous kind of thing. That's why the punishment of a false prophet, according to the Torah, is death. If a person prophesies, if a person comes to the Jewish people and he claims that God sent him, so then, if it's true, he's got to prove it. He's got to prove it, and there are very, very strict requirements for how someone is to prove. We have criteria for that. To prove that he really did receive a message from God. And if he fails to do so, and he's defined as a false prophet, he's put to death. And the Torah says, Lo Togurim, do not be afraid of him. Because that's the worst crime. to falsify the word of God? See, it's one thing for a person to go around and try to convince people ethically, morally, how they should live their life, but I'm not saying that I have a special message from God. So that's what he says. That's what the Rambam says. That prior to Moshe Rabbeinu, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were great religious leaders for the world, as we know. They're not just their own families. They had big gatherings of people. They were very significant. You see, when Avraham negotiated for the burial place, the Maris HaMachpelah, and they said, "You're a prince of God amongst us. You are a prince." They recognized him. Malki Shalem, when he came back from the war, he blessed him. Avraham was an Avimelech. Avimelech came to make a treaty with him. So he was a world-renowned figure. But how did he achieve his reputation? The Rambam says, at no point in time did Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob ever go to people and instruct them to do this or not do that, because God commanded me. God did communicate with them, and everything that God communicated with them had to do with them personally, but not for others. But they were great religious leaders. They only employed wisdom, reason, teaching, explaining, and they never said you should do this because God said so. They used the power of persuasion. Now that's a very, very significant thing. Religions do not use the power of persuasion. Religions all believe in swaying you emotionally. Getting, as I said, you take a look at any of these preachers on TV. They're very, very powerful. But for the first time in history, Hashem was sending Moshe with a message from God. That is to say, prophecy. That they were to do what he said, to accept him as the leader, to go to Paro, and whatever subsequent steps, for example, the step, that's not going to happen immediately, but they're going to be told to go to the Egyptians and to request gifts. All these things were serious things. And they were going to be told at a certain point to get up and to leave. And they're going to be told to bring the Passover sacrifice, which was an abomination to the Egyptians because they were going to use the sheep, which the Egyptians worshipped. And so on and so forth. So this was, why would they do this? Because now he's telling them God is talking. For the first time in history, you're going to have a situation where people are going to have to act on the basis of prophecy. And then the question is going to arise, how do I know that God spoke to you? It's one thing to try and convince me rationally. All right, then I'll listen to your arguments. If they make sense, I'll accept them. But now you're telling me to accept it because God spoke to you. Prove it. That's what he said, they will not believe in me. Because they will say God did not speak to you. That's what he was concerned about. When God said they will listen to your voice, he meant the part one. Part one will be a rational demonstration of the proofs for the existence of God and also the concept of God. Yeah, that they'll listen to because it makes sense, because that's something where you're appealing to their intelligence. You're going to explain it to them and they'll accept it. Part two is you're going to say that being who I just talked to you about, that being has communicated with me and there's a message for you. How do I know there's a message? Prove it. The intelligent response of a person to any claim of divine prophecy must be absolute proof. Otherwise, it's against the Torah. It's against the Torah to accept someone who as a prophet unless the Torah has given us guidelines. This is before the Torah was given. So God gave Moshe specific demonstrations. That's why when Moshe says they will not believe in me, He's not contradicting what God said. God said they will listen to your voice. That was said about something else. Moshe wasn't talking about that. Moshe was now referring to my claim. I'm going to come and claim that I'm a prophet. They're not going to believe in me. Because how can I prove it to them? Just because I know the concept of God, that's reason, that's logic. That doesn't prove that this being spoke to me. Indeed, in my opinion, even though the rabbis criticize him for this, because they say that he was referring to the Jews as an unbelieving people. But that's a midrashic level. In my opinion, when Moshe said this, that was a compliment to the Jewish people. That they're not a bunch of fools. They're not a bunch of suckers that just accept somebody. But they question, they challenge, they demand proof. And indeed, did God get angry with them? No, God then proceeded to give them proof. I'll give you proofs that you will have to do some things, you'll have to do some demonstrations which are contrary to the laws of nature. And he starts off with one, with take, what is that in your hand? Take the staff. and cast it onto the ground. And when you cast it onto the ground, it will become a snake. But this will not be like a magician's trick. It will not be sleight of hand. How do we know that it wasn't sleight of hand? And Moshe ran away from it. It was a real snake. And then God said, grab it by the tail. And as we said last week, that would be a foolish thing to do, because a snake, and then it turned into a stick. That was, you see, because the basic idea is that this is the laws of nature. How does that prove? That proves that because they're not going to assume that you can do this. They're not going to ascribe that kind of a power to you. Because no human being, any intelligent person. See, we don't believe that any person has supernatural power. The point of it is, with regard to messianic claims, it's absolutely clear that there's no the Mashiach is the one who will bring deliverance. Through him, God will bring deliverance. He'll defeat the enemies of the Jews. The Rambam gives a whole listing of things that he has to do in order to be qualified as the Mashiach. No one has done them. If a person is familiar with that, there's no way that you can be mistaken about it. However, throughout history, in times of stress, Jews became attached to certain very charismatic individuals, and they crossed the borderline. They began to sort of, to look up to them and to project powers onto them, almost to deify them. The Messiah will first and foremost, will bring the entire Jewish people back to a proper observance of Torah. Okay? So no one has done that today. To the contrary, I argued against this. In saying that, by the way, it's not clear whether the Rebbe himself claimed that he was the Mashiach. His Hasidim did. Whatever, I'm not getting into that part of it. But there was no doubt in my mind, and I was involved in a lot of debates, by simply following the Rambam. That is to say that the overwhelming majority of Jewish people today are not religiously observant. Everybody knows that. Only about 10% of the Jews. Okay, now one of the requirements is, in the Messianic era, the entire Jewish people will return to a proper observance of Torah. And it'll be brought about, in large part, through he'll be a great personality, wiser than King Solomon, and a tremendous communicator, and so on and so forth. Besides that, he will defeat the enemies of the Jews. So the four main things I would say would be, the main things, would be to win back the Jewish people to Torah through his tremendous power of teaching and persuasion, defeat the enemies of the Jews, which is obviously it has not come about. The Jews still have enemies who threaten them. In gathering of the exiles, well, that has begun to take place, but it's not complete. There's a significant amount of Jews that do not live in Israel. But the final one, the ultimate test, will be the rebuilding of the temple, the third temple, which will never be destroyed. Now, I said it's very, very simple to know that so-and-so can't be the Mashiach, because to date, not one of these things, not one of them, when you argue with them, he hasn't done even one. That's not to disparage him. By saying that someone is not the Mashiach, it's not a criticism. The Rambam wasn't the Mashiach either. But so then they would say, well, he's won over more people than anybody else. But that's not the point. The point is not who's won over more people. The point is the Rambam makes it clear that all of these things have to be accomplished completely. Now, getting back to the point over here, that's what Moshe Rabbeinu now is not being, obstinate. He merely said that in order to establish my claim of being a prophet, they're going to demand proof. People are going to demand proof. And as I'm saying, that's the correct thing. People should demand proof. So God gave him the miracles. Now let's ask ourselves a question. God gave him two signs and said that if they don't listen to the two, he'll give them another one, three. Why was there a need for more than one? There were different sets of demonstrations. One is for the Jews, to establish Moshe as a prophet. Once Moshe is established as a prophet, so then they'll follow him. If he's not established as a prophet, they're not going to follow him. They'll only follow him in that which makes sense according to reason, but not, I'm not going to do something because you're saying God told me to do it unless I know. How do I know that God wants me to do it? So you have to prove it. Again, you see the testimony to the skepticism of the Jews. One is not enough. Because who knows, maybe I didn't see it right, this, it's a fluke, it could be a fluke. So more proof, do it again. Maybe you're a good magician, maybe it was sleight of hand, maybe I missed something. So therefore God gave him the one with the snake, then God gives him with the leprosy, and then he says, and if they want more, if they want more, that's okay, good, don't get upset with them if they want more. And he gives him even a third one. Because the fact that it's constant repetition, then there has to be a point where you accept it. I mean, then some, obviously, it can't go on and on and on, because then that's just irrational, resistance to reality. But once he's established it, at least by three times, then you should follow him. So that's an important point, that this is the only religion in which there's an objective framework for the establishment of prophecy. All the other prophecies that the other nations follow, is, well, they can't prove it. They believe it, and they believe it, and that's the end of that story. But not according to the Torah. That's why today, whenever they make these claims, I'm very skeptical about all these rebbes, that all these miracle healings, you know, you hear about this, right? Or that he can predict the future. All these things, I'm extremely skeptical about. I don't, generally, I don't believe it at all. I mean, I'm saying if the person does have this power, so let him go public and convince the doctors, convince them to do things publicly. Or if this person has prophecy, so let's see some of the predictions. Make those kinds of predictions about future events that there's no way anybody could know. That's, by the way, once the Rambam holds that the need to do miracles was before the Torah was given. But once the Torah was established, one of the laws of the Torah is to follow a legitimate prophet. You must follow a legitimate prophet. And the Torah gave its own guidelines on what constitutes a legitimate prophet. First of all, the individual has to be someone who's capable of prophecy. He must be among the wisest and most perfected of men. So if the person is an ignoramus, we don't even listen to his claim. It's one of our fundamental principles that an ignoramus, God does not communicate with ignorant people. And all of the prophets were great, great geniuses, great thinkers, and highly perfected people on the highest possible level. So that's the first requirement. And thus, if an ordinary person who's not learned would come and claim that he was out in the field and God spoke to him, it's a joke. Nobody would go further. We wouldn't even demand any proof from him. We would not demand proof from him because it's an impossibility. Only someone who is deemed to be on a level of knowledge and wisdom that he might be a candidate for prophecy is taken to the next step. The next step would be he doesn't have to do miracles, the Rambam says. He does not have to do miracles today, after the Torah was given. What he needs to do is to establish the veracity by predicting future events. What does it mean predicting events in a specific kind of a way? Events that there's no way, you know, that anybody could predict, obviously. It means if he predicts the weather for tomorrow, even that's a little bit, but that's today we have the ability to predict that. He'd have to predict events. And then he says as follows. Even if they should come true, because you have, like, from time to time, was it Nostradamus? You have, you know, different people that they do make predictions, and sometimes you're amazed. They're pretty good. So the Rambam makes that point. He says there are individuals that from time to time do have the capability of being fairly accurate, in a way, of course, that impresses us. He says, however, you'll never find amongst those kinds of people, he doesn't mention Nostradamus, but apparently even in his day there were people that were pretty successful at making predictions. So he says, since that's the case, what's the difference between them and a genuine prophet? He says, you'll always find that these people are never 100% accurate. Even people that are impressive, they got it, they predicted that war would take place. And 50 years ago, they predicted a certain war would take place. Let's say. And they gave some general insights about where they did. It was general. But then you'll find the number of things they said weren't accurate. Because he says that's an impossibility, that every detail should be accurate. Thus he says that for a prophet to be established as a genuine prophet, he has to predict future events. And every detail must be true. Because if it's from God, you can't make a mistake. So if he's going to predict, if he would have predicted, say, the election, okay, that would have been interesting. Who could have predicted 4 years ago that a senator named Barack Obama, first time, would even run? If he would have predicted that, and then he would predict the outcome, and he would be able to give you a state by state. Now, it's possible. It is, I would say, would it be possible that somebody could have predicted this?
How could?
Could have predicted, excuse me, that someone like Obama would be the president. But when we get down to specifics, the particulars of the election, for example, the numbers, the states, and so on and so forth, that would be impossible. That would be impossible. So if the person would claim to be a prophet and he'd base himself on that kind of a prediction, which was very impressive, which would amaze us, how would he know that? But there'd be specifics where he'd be wrong. Then he'd be disqualified. That's how demanding the test is. Thus, all the people in our history that we accept as prophets, going back to Moshe, and then we had Samuel and Isaiah and Jeremiah, the whole world accepts them as prophets because they were subjected to this very arduous test. And also, under the pain of death. Had they failed the test, they would be put to death as a false prophet.
If that wasn't
the prophets were very, very brave. It was a very dangerous profession. It's an interesting phenomenon. Just a little bit of a side point, because we're talking about this guy Osteen or whatever it is, that generally speaking, the successful theologians or these preachers are people, when you listen to them, they're very good, but they're also saying things that people want to believe. And many rabbis are the same thing. If a rabbi wants to be successful, he's not going to upset the people too much. So but he knows that his task, at times he has to get up and chastise or whatever it is, and criticize. He has to, because then he's a phony. I mean, people have a need for a little bit of that. So a smart person knows his boundary lines, what's acceptable. But if it gets too blatant, if it's too true, let's put it that way, if it's too painful, then he runs risks, because he might hurt feelings, the wrong feelings, the wrong people's feelings. So that's a tension. Every rabbi has to struggle with that. I mean, to what extent he has to take risks if he's really committed to the truth, and there are certain evils going on, then he may have to take a chance. But the point is correct that the prophets in Israel did not always fare that well. They weren't beloved characters, because they, as the Rambam says, they could not withhold the truth. Their perfection was such, and their loyalty to the word of God was such that they couldn't control it. They could, even if they knew they were going to be killed, they could not help themselves. That was their level of dedication to the truth.